You are listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Carnegie Endowment. It's a great pleasure for me to welcome Robert Lacey to come and speak about Saudi Arabia and what's going on, not only inside the kingdom, but especially in light of recent events in the region and the wave of protests and uprisings that we see taking root across the region. There's been an awful lot of speculation in recent days and weeks about would the events transpiring in Tunisia and Egypt and other places ever come to Saudi Arabia? And I think this is an excellent question that I hope Robert will enlighten us on today. Our friend Bernard Heichel often says that the bookshelf on Saudi Arabia is very short. And I think it's great that we have someone here who's written not one but two fabulous books about the kingdom, including the most recent, Inside the Kingdom, which I would recommend you all read. So with that, Robert, I'm going to ask you to speak for about 30 minutes, and then we'll have a discussion.
Thanks very much, Chris. It's a great pleasure to be back with you. Well, not back with you, but with you personally. I have enormous respect for your work. All you've certainly taught me about the Saudi redemption program, the care program, and I can't wait to, sorry, this will be agony, twisting the knife in your heart, can't wait to read what you've got to say about the ulama, and the Saudi ulama, a much under-discussed subject. It's also lovely to come to the think tank with the best food in town. That's how one judges think tanks in Washington, and I haven't come across better than this. I'll get straight into it. Chris says 30 minutes talk. I'll go through some of the basics about Saudi Arabia. Those of you who know it, please forgive me if it seems obvious, but sometimes it's worth looking at the basics when one's discussing the big sort of question that Chris has just raised. Here is Saudi Arabia and the map that tells us, obviously, why it matters to us and why it matters particularly to America. There's the obvious answer. Down there, this map, which has been pulled out of Saudi Arabia's eastern province, 20% of the known oil reserves on Earth, all under the control of this country, Saudi Arabia, third or fourth largest gas reserves in the world. So that's what's there on the east, and of course on the west, the holy places of Mecca and Medina. Which for many Muslims matter far more than the oil fields. And holding it all together in the middle, Riyadh, just south of Daria, the ancestral home of the House of Saud, who created this state, as you know. I must confess, when I first started researching and writing about this country back in the 1970s, more than 30 years ago, I'm afraid I thought that Saudi Arabia was Arabic for Southern Arabia. I didn't realize that it is, of course, it's not quite the only country in the world named after its ruling family. Liechtenstein, for complicated reasons I can explain later, is also named after its ruling family and not the place where it is. But, of course, it is Arabia as pulled together, as built, as controlled, and, frankly, as still owned by the House of Saud. And let me try a very early answer to the question that Chris has just posed. What lies in the future? You can see it on the map. Here, in the oil fields, you have wealth, you have money, you have westernization, you have what we call modernization. You have McDonald's, you have Colonel Sanders, you have women who wear bikinis on the beach. You have kids who answer back to their parents. You have all that goes with, in the eyes of many Saudis, westernization. And then here on the other side, you have the emblems of tradition and ethics and moral values to a very straightforward and simply understood code. And it is the task of the people in the middle there, the House of Saud, to manage the conflicts between those two. So I don't know what's going to happen in Saudi Arabia in the future. All I can tell you, it will be a result of those two forces and how they play off against each other and how well the House of Saud in the middle can manage change. Here is the first picture ever taken of the House of Saud exactly 100 years ago. This photograph is dated 1911. You can see it in the archives of the Royal Geographical Society in Kensington Gore in London. And it's a famous picture. I'm sure those of you who've studied the history know it. There we see, we presume, Abdulaziz somewhere on one of those camels. Certainly we see the original form of the modern Saudi flag, the plain green flag with the Islamic confession of faith. There is no God but God, and Muhammad is his prophet. I am very fond of this photograph because it was taken by a Brit. It's taken by Captain William Shakespeare. And those of you who know the history of Saudi Arabia and will know about him. He was indeed, in fact, descended from the great playwright and bard, and for reasons best known to themselves, his parents decided to call him Bill. He didn't pursue poetry, he pursued photography. He took this photograph with the early 20th century equivalent of an IMAX camera, an enormous plate glass camera which he carried with him wherever he went on a camel, and he had a train of camels which had his darkroom with him, and he produced these pictures. And more significantly, the reason why he took this picture was because the British were finally starting to take notice of the House of Saud and worry about what they might be doing in the middle of Arabia and why, and this is what they're actually doing at this moment, this is taken near Al-Khaj, why they were riding eastwards. And it was soon after this that indeed they went fully eastwards and annexed the eastern province, as we now call it. Significant in those days for having the largest date groves on earth. Significant, as we've already said, nowadays for having the largest oil reserves on earth. And of course, if we, the British, had known what was under the sand, we'd never have let them do it. But at the time, we didn't know. The significance of Shakespeare being there was that he was British agent in Kuwait. Just briefly to go back and state the obvious about, imagine this is the beginning of the 20th century, and these, the Emirates, as we now call them, hadn't yet been unified and codified. As we, the British, looked at Arabia, of course, why it mattered was because of the Suez Canal, which linked us with our empire here in India. And when I wrote my first book, The Kingdom, in the early 80s, it's the story of Saudi Arabia from 1743 up to the date I finished, 1979. Most of my research was not done in the archives of the British Foreign Office, but in the archives of the British India Office, because that was those were the British diplomats who studied Arabia. Our power was expressed in the Gulf, which, of course, we then cheerfully called the Persian Gulf, because through agents like William Shakespeare, each one of the sheikdoms with which we're familiar today, he was in Kuwait, but Bahrain and Abu Dhabi and the others, had a British agent who was, in fact, he wasn't called an ambassador, he ran the town, and he kept the sheikh on side and made sure that that particular port remained safe for British interests. And Abdulaziz knew about this system when he left Kuwait in 1901 on his famous journey to conquer Riyadh. And the first thing he did, and you will never read this in official Saudi textbooks, is to write to the British government in New Delhi, he knew where to write, to ask if he could join the system and if a British agent could be sent to Riyadh. Because he knew that meant money, it meant armaments, it meant the umbrella of the British Empire. And we, the British, ignored the letters. You can see them in the India office, in the archives of the India office. A succession of letters written in Arabic with an English translation, and memos saying just ignore this. And it's not until 1911 that we start to realize that perhaps we should take the House of Saud a bit more seriously. Shakespeare was sent to meet Abdulaziz, and as was famously the case with almost every European who met Abdulaziz, he fell under his spell. He couldn't wait to get back and spend time. He kept his journals, wonderful descriptions of these early years of the House of Saud. And of course, as you probably know, he actually died in battle, not fighting, but observing on behalf of the British government a battle between the al-Saud and the al-Rashid, and his head was cut off and taken back to Hail in triumph by the enemy. Here's another photographed by another British agent, 1917, Harry St. John Philby is the agent in this case. I see heads nodding. Philby, of course, is a notorious name because his son, Kim Philby, was the great traitor in the Cold War of British interest and indeed American Western interest to the Soviet Union. We in Britain consider Harry St. John Philby even more of a traitor than Kim Philby, and I'll come to that just a little later. I always, when I show this photograph in Saudi Arabia, I always get appreciative nods, and there's always somebody in the audience who's related to one of these characters along here beside Abdulaziz. Here is, of course, Abdulaziz ibn Saud, towering, almost towering over everybody else. And again, this picture has a particular fondness. I regard it with a particular fondness because when I first went to Saudi Arabia in 1979 to start my research on the book that became The Kingdom, I, by dint of persistence and sitting for a long time in the office of Sheikh Abdul Wahhab, got an audience with King Khalid. And I wondered what I could take as my present to this potentate who had everything. And I hit on the idea of making up an album of these photographs, which were then comparatively unknown. Now they're in every coffee table book on Arabia you'll see, but they were quite relatively unknown. This one actually is from St. Anthony's College, Oxford. And I made up the album. I had English captions put there. I had classical Arabic captions. It was one of the king's tribal majesties. The tribal leaders were there. There were poets reciting. It was all the color. There was smoke wafting, coffee being served, you know, all the magic of traditional Arabia. And when all this was over, it was time for me to be ushered forward. I could see the poor old king sort of lifting his eyebrows to think he had to deal with yet another foreigner, offering him something he didn't want and asking him for favors he couldn't grant. And when he opened the album, he suddenly came alive, particularly when he saw this photograph. He said, I remember that. He said, I remember the Hawaja, the Western gentleman. This is all through a translator. We had to go and stand in the sun, he said, for about 30 seconds. And I'm old enough to remember when to have a photograph taken, you had to go and stand in the sun while Dad stood there with the box brownie. And he put his hand on a blanket, and he said, and I've never seen the picture. He said, that's me in the foreground. That is the future King Khalid with his elder brother, Prince Muhammad, beside him. And so that's why this picture means so much to me, because it seemed to me just to symbolize so much of what we need to know if you want to understand Saudi Arabia. We're, of course, quite entitled to judge Saudi Arabia by our own standards and Western standards and the standards drawn up by the Human Rights Commission and so on. But somehow, if you remember that less than 100 years ago, the king of Saudi Arabia was a barefoot urchin in the sand. No idea anybody had of the wealth that this family would one day command and, you know, what changes were to come. I think you start to put things in perspective. And then, of course, the other thing was that at the end of the majlis, the king, the call to prayer sounded, and the king, he could still at that point pray properly, got out of his chair and knelt with everybody else. Here is a simplified modern family tree of the House of Saud. Again, those of you who are experts will recognize all these names and faces. I'll just run through it. They're just the same. There, of course, is Abdulaziz ibn Saud, died in 1953. Here are his sons by different wives who have succeeded him. Here are the names of the wives, reminding us that King Faisal, of course, was descended from the Al-Sheikh family, the descendants of Abdul Wahhab, the preacher, the founder of what we call Wahhabism. Here's my friend, King Khalid, King Fahad, and of course now King Abdullah. And again, sorry to state the obvious to those of you who know, but this is a reminder again of how the House of Saud is not just a family. It's veering towards a political party, obviously, because it lobbies very much in its own interests, but it also has a nationwide character, because when you look at these names, you are looking at the names, well, not with Al-Sheikh, but the other names here, Suderi, of course. Here's a Rashidi connected name. You're looking at the names of tribes from all over Saudi Arabia, and as frequently and perhaps improperly been said, King Abdulaziz unified Saudi Arabia with a sword of steel and a sword of flesh. And whenever, as you know, he conquered or assimilated an area, he would marry into that particular family. And that system lives in the identities of the princes who are governors of the different provinces, who have blood ties not only with the House of Saud, but with the area and the tribal influences in which they live. Again, to state the obvious, this, of course, is largely a horizontal family tree. And that is unusual and different from the average Western family tree, which is vertical, going from father to eldest born and so on down. The problem with that, the vertical family tree that we have in Europe, certainly, well, you have it with your presidents, too, from time to time. You know, George Bush the elder begets George Bush the younger and so on. You know all about monarchies and royal families. Is what I call the idiot factor. Well, maybe there you are with George Bush. No, sorry. But, you know, the trouble with the idiot factor is you can't prevent a George III or a Prince Chapman. I didn't say that, but you cannot, you have no control over who will take the reins, whereas this horizontal system enables more subtle maneuverings to take place. An ability can actually enter the picture, as those of you who know the history know. Here is King Saud, who was deposed from the throne 5 years before he died because the family didn't consider him an appropriate monarch. And here, particularly with King Khalid, we see how the system works, because his elder brother, whom we saw in that photograph just now, standing beside him, was not judged suitable by the family to take on the succession. He was a great, he was known as Abu Sharin, the father of two evils. The evils were said to be anger and alcohol. He was a very aggressive, forceful man. He had actually, as a young man, he led the Saudi army that occupied and took possession of Medina. He was a major figure in the family of far more importance and weight than King Khalid, but the family didn't want him. They were worried about what would happen if he became crown prince or king, and his temper got the better of him. And those of us who know the story know what happened, that when he discovered in the 1970s that one of his granddaughters was having a love affair with a man of whom he disapproved, well, just having a love affair outside marriage, he had the two of them arrested and executed on his own authority. And that, of course, was the subject of the Western movie made by the BBC, but actually financed by your National Public Radio, or is it anyway? It's your station in Boston that produces those wonderful programs. That was Death of a Princess. It was a bad enough scandal. Think what a worse scandal it would have been if the Mohammed, the old man in the movie, had actually been the king of Saudi Arabia. I was there in Saudi Arabia in 79 when the movie came out. I remember the poor British ambassador getting sent home for 18 months to pay the price for the impertinence. Couple more things about the family tree before we move on. And just one other thing, just sort of from the point of view of British history. We in Britain used to have this system until, that's why I can be so rude about the hereditary, the vertical system which the French brought in. We, the English, had this system already. It was called the Atheling system, the Anglo-Saxons. Atheling means throne-worthy. Every senior male member of the family, it was considered in Anglo-Saxon times throne-worthy. So when in the 8th century, 9th century, King Ethelred, not Ethelred the Unready, but the great warrior King Ethelred was killed in battle by the Vikings, leaving a couple of teenage sons. The family said, we can't have these boys running us at this time. Let's go to his brother, who's such a great general. And that is how we in England got King Alfred. The only king in our history is known as Alfred the Great. But as I say, then the French came along, and we've had father to son ever since. There are three factors that determine succession in the Saudi royal family. The first is age and seniority. The second is competence. And the third is, and this is never discussed, the identity of the mother. There are people here who are older than not perhaps of King Abdullah, but of Prince Naif, who is named as second deputy premier and clearly destined to become crown prince and king if mortality goes the way it might be expected. I mean, for example, Prince Migran down here is often mentioned in... now the Soviet Union has vanished, all those sort of people who love royal family trees, and well, perhaps you think I do, spending so much time on this, you know, Sovietologists, criminologists, they all try and dig around in the House of Saud, and they say, well, look at this lovely, bright man, Prince Migran, bright man he is indeed, head of Saudi intelligence, he is a future king. He's not, because his mother was an African slave. And, you know, he will never become a king. The family decided at the sort of, I am told, and this is, I have no written evidence for this, obviously, but it was decided informally in the family at the time when King Saud was on the throne and fathering countless children by African and foreign concubines, that the blood of foreign women couldn't contaminate the blood of the House of Saud. I mean, it sort of makes sense. Saudi Arabia must be represented by an Arab king. You can't have a half caste. Now, there's an extra snobbery here involved that, you know, this is particularly felt, of course, by the Sudairis and the other tribal family members. But that is one of the reasons why, you know, Prince Talal, quite apart from his unconventional views and history, could never be king because his mother was an Armenian. The same goes for Nawaf, and the same goes for the very bright and English-speaking Prince Satam. Their mothers disqualify them from the succession. I will come on later to say none of this matters in the slightest because the importance, the ability of the House of Saud is about their ability to create consensus among themselves and in the country. Whoever is the particular figurehead at the time, obviously in an autocracy, has a great deal of power, but he can only rule with the consent of his brothers, and it will in due course be, you know, wider members of the family. And that's, you know, that's what matters about who's going to succeed in the House of Saud, their ability to hold together around and form a coalition. You know, at the moment in Britain, we're very conscious of this. We have our conservative-liberal coalition. Well, that's exactly what's ruling Saudi Arabia at the moment. It's the other way around. There's the liberal, King Abdullah, and here's the conservative, Prince Naif. As we know, Prince Sultan is not really very active these days in the actual affairs of government. So Prince Naif is the face of conservatism in Saudi Arabia. I don't share the fears that people have about what's going to happen in the future if and more probably when he becomes king. He's a realist. I mean, he is a police chief. He's been chasing down terrorists for 30 years. You don't expect a man like that to be full of sweetness and light. But his presence right at the front of the Saudi government is very reassuring for the large number of people in Saudi Arabia who are conservative and makes it possible for them to swallow the sort of liberal reforms that King Abdullah is now famously putting forward and will be putting forward, I'm sure, as long as he has breath in his body. You know, I don't need to tell you about the seven Sudairi brothers and their cohesion within the family. Just a remark about Prince Abdullah, though, King Abdullah, Prince Abdullah as he was, you know, there are no brothers for him. And I think one of the secrets of King Abdullah's success as a consensus builder was the, based on the sadness of his mother dying when he was quite young, he just had two sisters whom he's looked after and to whom he's devoted deeply. I think that had two results. One, it made him very good at reaching out, at doing deals with people like Nawaf and Mitaib, although Mitaib is now disaffected because, you see, Prince Mitaib there was the Minister of Municipalities. He's older than Prince Naif. So when Prince Naif's appointment was announced, Mitaib was furious, and we saw that he was furious. He renounced, he resigned from the Ministry of Municipalities, handed it over to his son. He didn't have to do it at that particular moment. Prince Talal, of course, true to his character, actually gave a press conference saying he disapproved of it, just as he's giving press conferences now. So you know, these are all the sort of tensions that go on. As I say, King Abdullah became very adept at dealing with his brothers, at making alliances, and not, you know, not necessarily in direct Well, I mean, it is one person said to me who knows him very well, you know, said that he bitterly disagreed with virtually everything that King Fahad did when King Fahad was actively running the country. But he loyally kept his peace and supported what he was doing and did what he could to mitigate things as he saw them. And then the other thing about King Abdullah and the fact that he grew up with his sisters, people close to him cite that as one of the reasons for the particular sympathy and empathy he has with women's causes in Saudi Arabia. Quite enough genealogy. Here's oil. Can anybody tell me, I expect many of you know this, what this is down in the foreground? I don't think we'll even organize the contest. These beehives, does anybody know what they are? This is the roof of a mosque. What we're looking at here, these are not ovens. These are the traditional sorts of air pockets that are put, have for centuries been put on the top of mosques. This is the first active oil well, photographed about 1937, 1938, well number seven. Famously, it took seven penetrations to get to the oil. King Abdulaziz said that he wanted the first amount of the oil, the first revenue of the oil, to build a mosque. So that's what this is here. There are the huts where the workers were living. And the mosque stands there to this day over the hill at Aramco. The oil is long since, the oil well is long since capped. And here's the beginning of the famed Saudi-American relationship. And again, I expect many of you know this story. This just brings me back to why we consider the Brits, why we consider Harry St. John Filby a much greater traitor than his son, because he was given by Abdulaziz the task of setting up the auction for the oil rights. And he said, well, let's get the Brits in because they'll push the price up. But, you know, if you let the British have the oil, they interfere with you just like they interfere with everybody else in the Gulf. They've got so much oil anyway, they probably won't really exploit it with any great enthusiasm. Just use them as a stalking horse to get the price up for the Americans. Now, they've got lots of money. And the nice thing he said about the Americans is, of course, they're on the other side of the world, and they're never going to come over here and interfere with what we are doing. And that seemed to fit with what Abdulaziz knew. He had already met Americans, in fact. He probably met more Americans at that stage in his life than Brits. And the only Brits he'd met had been these conniving agents like Filby and Shakespeare and so on, trying to get him to do things. And the Americans he'd met were all hearty Christian missionaries from the island of Bahrain who cheerfully came over and looked after his men, looked after his own eye. He was, of course, blind in one eye by this stage of his life, looked after his dear old father, Abdurrahman, came all the way to Riyadh, never tried for a minute to convert or proselytize anybody, won his great affection and respect. So he said, yes, the Americans are the straightforward types we need. And this, of course, is the moment when he discovered it wasn't quite so straightforward as that. We know about this because of this gentleman here, Commander William Perry. He was then a translator in the armed forces, Arabist. He became your first proper ambassador in Saudi Arabia. I think ambassador or maybe consul in Jeddah, and he has left his wonderful account of this meeting when Roosevelt, who had just come back from Yalta, it's 1945 we're looking at here, Roosevelt hasn't got long to live, but he'd attended this meeting in Yalta where the victorious powers, Churchill, Roosevelt, and Stalin met to decide how the post-war world would be divided up. And Roosevelt, knowing about Saudi oil reserves, actually wanting to come down and see the King of Egypt, who was even then seen as important by the Americans, came down to the Great Bitter Lake. And Abdulaziz, the only time he ever left the country, was brought up on a cruiser to meet him. And apparently, virtually as they sat down, Roosevelt said to him, "I'm so pleased to see you, Your Majesty," through Perry. Because I've got a problem I'd like your help with. And Abdulaziz said, well, what's the problem? He said, well, I'd like you to help me find a home for the Jews in the Middle East. And Abdulaziz apparently said, well, why is this? I mean, he knew full well what was coming. But Roosevelt said, well, we've just discovered the dreadful things that have happened to the Jews, and of course that was quite right. It was really only 1945, as the Russian armies went into Eastern Europe, that the full horrors of the Holocaust became known. And he said, you know, we think we should find them a home of their own in the Middle East. And because, in Abdelaziz said, why? He said, well, because they've suffered so much. And they've had terrible things done to them. And apparently Abdelaziz said, well, who did these terrible things to them? And Roosevelt said, the Germans. So he said, well, why not give them a piece of Germany? That's the way we would operate. I mean, he didn't quite say give them Bavaria. But that was his simple logic. Of course, the American simple logic was later expressed by Truman when asked why America gave such recognition and favor to Israel. He said, well, gentlemen, I can see what you're saying and getting at, but I have hundreds of thousands of Jewish citizens among my electorate that I have to answer to, and not many Arabs. And that, of course, as we know, remains the basic reality to this day and the basis of the Saudi-American love-hate relationship. Here's something else that America brought to Saudi Arabia education. This is an Aramco typing class. Here's a little Bedouin boy in the foreground who grew up tending sheep and goats, and I expect some of you know who he is. He is Ali Niemi, who rose to become the chief executive of Aramco and is still to this day the oil minister. They say he's going to go in the forthcoming reshuffle. I don't know. Apparently, last year he went to see King Abdullah and said, look, I'm 75. I think it's time for me to go. I mean, he didn't want to go. He doesn't want to go. But you know, he felt to, you know, it's a proper American way of managing things. And King Abdullah just said, only 75? And so he's still there. There is another more famous oil minister, Sheikh Yamani, who was the voice of OPEC in the 1970s when the price of oil rose thanks to the American oil embargo from $2 a barrel to $34, $35 by the end of the decade. That's what Time magazine thought about it in 1979 when I started writing my book. There's King Faisal, the architect of the oil embargo, which for reasons I never quite understood was against America and the Netherlands. Everybody suffered, of course, but in some way the Netherlands had done something to aid Israel in the Ramadan War that offended the king. Here are the sons of Abdelaziz who've ruled the kingdom, King Khalid on the left, King Faisal, King Fahad, and of course on the right, King Abdullah. Let's just go back to King Abdullah then, because when this picture was taken, it was just about when, no, it was before I came to Saudi Arabia, there is Abdullah. One of the things people forget about Abdullah was the fact that he had a terrible stutter. You know, talk about the king's speech. This man, I can remember, and this is why I, for one, am pretty sanguine about Prince Naif. What people worry about Naif now is nothing to what Western analysts were saying about Abdullah in the late 70s and early 80s. This strange tribal character, gruff, black beard, stuttered. I mean, I met him. I remember he couldn't string two words together. He wasn't as bad as George VI. And one of the great gifts of your State Department or whoever it was to send over one or maybe more speech therapists with whom he worked very conscientiously. So now when you meet him, there is virtually no stutter at all. 1979, here's the first. November 1979, this smoke is rising from the Grand Mosque. There on the left, we've seen Jehman al-Otaibi, the leader of the extremists who seized the Grand Mosque, partly in fulfillment of a supposed Islamic prophecy that a Messiah would come with the new century. It was the end of 1399. As Prince Salman pointed out, actually the century didn't end in the end of 1939. It didn't end till the end of 1400, but still, they weren't too worried about the mathematics of it. And here was, as I say, our first glimpse of the Islamic beard, and this is the event that pushed Saudi Arabia, in our Western terms, backwards. I can remember when I lived in Saudi Arabia in 79, there were women water skiing on the creek. You don't see that nowadays in Saudi Arabia. And indeed, the same, you know, because they're friends of mine, these Saudi ladies, and they're now old and grizzled like me. Well, no, that's indelicate to them. That's impolite to them. But They happily wear the abaya. They happily wear the veil. They wouldn't let their daughters go water skiing, certainly not in Saudi Arabia, in a swimming costume, because they have genuinely come to feel that Islam and serious, perhaps not fundamentalist Islam, but at least pious Islam, provides them and their families with the sort of bulwark against the materialism of the West that they would like to preserve for a bit longer. Here are some of the, finally, there were 200 to 300 who invaded the mosque. By the time the fighting was over 2 weeks later, about 150 or so survived. They were tried. 70 or so of them were condemned to death and taken to the particular regions from which they came and beheaded publicly. And here is their mentor, although this wasn't realized at the time. I write about this in my new book, Inside the Kingdom. They were all pupils of Sheikh bin Baz. And indeed, Prince Naif and his men had arrested virtually all of the men who captured the Grand Mosque, and they were chasing Jehman. And it was Sheikh bin Baz who went to see Prince Naif and vouched for the Islamic credentials of these young men and said they will come, you know, they will do you no harm. And so they were released from jail. And so even as the House of Saud in the late 1970s, early 1980s participated in the conservatization of Saudi Arabia, if you want to call it that, the going backwards in our terms, they had a healthy wariness as to the role that the church establishment had played in all of this. I mean, here's Prince Fahad, as he then was, at a girls' comprehensive school in London, 1953. I'm not quite sure what the headmistress is doing under the desk, but the importance of this picture is it's 10 years before girls' education becomes official in Saudi Arabia. Here is the education minister investigating it 10 years early. Here he is with another friend that Saudi Arabia supported, of course, during the Iraq-Iran war, another friend for whom he cheerfully stumped up $32 million. I don't need to go into the details of the Iran-Contra affair, which all became public later, but you know, it's now becoming known the degree to which Saudi Arabia acted as America's surrogate in the 1970s and 80s. The Safari Club, which Prince Turki al-Faisal helped organize with French intelligence, Egyptian soldiers, Saudi money, and fighting called the Safari Club, and the Shah. We know about this because the Persians were involved, and the Shah, when he fled in 1979, considerately left all the papers about the Safari Club. It's sort of early WikiLeaks scandal on his desk. 5 minutes, says Chris, so I'll move on rapidly. Here's one result of Saudi American collaboration in the 1980s. This photograph is taken, of course, when Osama bin Laden was a hero, 1987 or so, in a cave somewhere in Afghanistan. And this is the event that turned him from being a friend of the House of Saud to an enemy. I remember when I was doing the research for my book, talking to Prince Ahmed bin Abdulaziz, who described how Osama bin Laden came to him as he went to a number of his brothers with this plan, full of anger already at the House of Saud for admitting Americans to the Holy Land. Big question is whether the House of Saud actually ever had any choice and whether the Americans wouldn't have arrived just the same if King Fahad hadn't invited them, but that's a big question perhaps. But he said it is disgraceful that we should depend on these Western crusaders, his famous words, to rid the country of this enemy. He had a much better idea. He'd worked it out. He would get together his volunteers. They would infiltrate Iraq. They infiltrate Iraq-occupied Kuwait. They would fight door to door, house to house. Quite a plausible plan, because the Iraqi soldiers had no spine, as we discovered. And as Arab fighters, free this Arab city without the help of the West. But by this stage, it was too late. It's most improbable the House of Saud wanted to become debtors to Osama bin Laden in any case. And there are Saudi soldiers fighting at the one actual piece of action in the Gulf War in which they participated, the Battle of Al-Kafji. on the Iraqi border, where they performed creditably and valiantly. It's most unlikely that the House of Saud would have wanted to become an ally of Osama bin Laden. And as events turned out, of course, they didn't. This is Al-Watan from the 12th of September, 2001, the familiar pictures, the news agency diagrams. The important thing here is this statement here, issued by the Saudi government in response to what had happened. It wasn't, of course, known at that point who had taken part, but there was a suspicion it must be something to do with bin Laden or Saudis. And here, the Saudi government is expressing its sympathy and regret and condolences with America and saying that what had happened was totally out of kilter and totally out of sympathy with Saudi values. But of course, as the days went by, it became clear that 15 of the 19 hijackers were in fact Saudis, and they had in fact imbibed their values in Saudi Arabia, in Saudi schools, reading prejudiced Saudi textbooks, listening to prejudiced Saudi preachers. And this becomes the theme of the following 10 years, which is coming up to the 10th anniversary of 9/11. And here is Frank Gardner, the BBC correspondent who went to report on the war between when Al-Qaeda actually came out onto the streets in Saudi Arabia in May 2003 and fought its three-year campaign and was defeated by it. Here is Frank today, still, you probably know him, some of you, wonderful reporter, and bravely soldiering on in his wheelchair. His cameraman wasn't so lucky, he was killed on the spot. Chris knows all about this. Some people call this the Betty Ford Clinic for repentant extremists. It's the Saudi rehab camp. We'll move on from that. We can talk more about that later. Very interesting example of Saudi Arabia thinking far more and being far more progressive and civilized in response to the threat of terrorism than people give them credit for. At the moment, they're still operating in these old picnic gardens, but they're building a purpose-built facility. And here is our hero of the hour, King Abdullah, when he still had a stutter. Here he is visiting the house of the poor. Well, there's only one Arab and only one king in this picture. Here's the G20 gathering together in October 2008 to try and work out what to do about the world crisis of that time. Saudi Arabia, of course, having weathered it better than most countries thanks to its financial conservatism. Here's my last slide. I like to call this Elvis and his fan club. It is King Abdullah at one of the national dialogue meetings that he's instigated, which still work to this day. Obviously, the theme of many of these meetings are women's rights. That's my time up. I hope you've enjoyed this. And I'd now, please, ask me questions. How do you want to do it, Chris?
Well, I think first of all, I'd like to thank you for providing all the context I think that we need to have when we're discussing Saudi Arabia. It strikes me that people have been forecasting the downfall of the kingdom for years, and in the last couple of weeks we've seen a spate of op-eds and commentaries talking about either this regime is too calcified to survive or is so incredibly poised to manage this wave of transition that's going on. Before I open it up for questions and to get you to respond to all these, I kind of like to press you on this point that for someone who spent the past 30 years looking at these issues, I think a big question that an awful lot of people have is, you know, King Abdullah comes back from 3 months of recuperation and announces $36 billion worth of spending. And I think there's an awful lot of speculation and thought that, you know, is this what Saudi Arabia needs to right now? Is this what Saudis want? I mean, for someone who's spent the past, you know, three decades looking at these things, I'd really like to hear what your thoughts are on what is it that Saudis want when they're looking out and seeing what's going on in the world. Is it just more, a better mortgage? Is it better purchasing power? Are there more things that they'd like?
Well, the standard response of Saudi radicals to King Abdullah's economic package is it is our right. It's just bribery. And that is their point of view. I'll I'll put my position on this right on the table. We obviously, when I spend my time in Riyadh, going back to Riyadh on Sunday night, I love sitting with the liberals. I love sitting with the radicals. Apart from anything, they can speak English. And they deal with all the ideas that I like. And, of course, Western journalists read the radical websites. What they don't read are the equal number, in fact, greater number, of conservative Arabic websites, which are fiercely critical of this man for being photographed with women. I mean, this photograph wasn't released in Saudi Arabia for many years. I had to get it sort of secretly. Just last year, there was a picture released of him and Prince Sultan at the same time with women. But, you know, just a picture like this causes a great deal of resentment in Saudi Arabia, just as one of King Abdullah of Jordan's major problems is the fact that Queen Rania is always in Hello magazine with Western women in bikinis and Western fashions. And that greatly undermines his and her credibility in that country. But we're talking about Saudi Arabia. The British Embassy did a poll, which is worth more or less as any poll, a few months ago before this trouble, if trouble it is, started. They asked Saudis about change and what they thought about change. 20% said they'd like more change. And it's my belief that 20% are the ones that I meet and we read quoted in the Herald Tribune and New York Times and everything else. 20% said they thought things were fine as they were, and 60% said things had gone too far. There had been too much change. Now, these are the people who don't like the idea of a university where men and women mingle on campus. They are horrified that their king should take pride in building more of these. So that's one answer about Saudi conservatism. And to answer your specific point about the other aspect of Saudi, the other aspect of King Abdullah's economic package, the other great conservatism in Saudi Arabia, which never gets mentioned because it's boring, is economic conservatism and financial conservatism and the incredible power that SAMA, the monetary agency, exercises and actually exercises over men like King Abdullah. You can't do that, sir. You know, we'll devalue the rial. And as a result of Saudi Arabia's great conservatism, as I said, it weathered 2008 very well. But in fact, with all the oil revenues that have been flooding into the country recently, it could well afford to spend this money, $37 billion. It's in fact 10% just about of the Saudi annual budget. And all I know is that every merchant I've spoken to in Jeddah is exultant. At last, there's some money to play with. They complain endlessly that the government doesn't let enough money out. Now, you may say that's just Jeddah merchants who like the business. But, you know, countries run on business. And so, I think in a year or so's time, we'll look back on this package as the first stage of something, the economic package first. Of course, being Saudi, King Abdullah couldn't say we're scared stiff about what's happening in the rest of the Middle East. Here's a bribe. You know, it's all to do with the traditional homecoming largesse that gets showered even before Egypt happened. All the civil servants were looking forward to 2 months' pay when King Abdullah came home, you know, because that's what happens. But as I say, I think it's the first stage of a series of reforms, and obviously we know what the next one is going to be. It's long been discussed and rumored. It would probably have happened by now if King Abdullah hadn't fallen ill, and they wouldn't be... It's a cabinet reshuffle. Now he's got to bring it out after everything that's happening. And, of course, we in the West will say, oh, it's simply his reaction to events. This cabinet reshuffle has been long, long planned, as he planned his last one. Took months of consultation to push it through. He's just gone out to the desert, I think, today or yesterday or this week, for his traditional holiday. Well, it's not a holiday. It will be spent with people coming and discussing, you know, the reshuffle. Now, you know, it will be partly a matter of personnel. The thing I have heard in Riyadh, although it is just a rumor, is that it will also involve something constitutional, that it will be declared that, two things I have heard, but this is just hearsay, but I pass it on. The first is that The king, it will be declared that the king no longer has to attend every council of ministers' meetings, and a particular minister will be named as a sort of chief executive. I don't know what title he will be given, but that will be seen as a step towards constitutional monarchy, perhaps, separating the dignity of the throne. To make this acceptable to conservatives, it will also certainly be Prince Naif who gets given this job. Prince Salman himself thinks that he should get the job, and perhaps he'll get it soon enough when Prince Naif becomes king. But that is, as I say, this is just one thing that people are talking about in Riyadh, but it makes sense. It also deals with the issue of let's have, you know, I mean, it is a problem, and they know it's a problem to have men in their 70s and 80s running a dynamic country. As we all get old, we feel loss of energy and, you know, the back pain. I mean, think of the terrible back pain the man has had, agonizing. We're told he's doing well in his therapy, is ahead with his therapy. He'll be standing up properly by September, and let's hope that he is. But he will use his own infirmity as a way of stepping backwards and bringing forward this reform that he wants. Sorry I'm taking too long, Chris, but I got some important things to get across. The other idea that is mooted in Riyadh is that a new ministry will be created of the provinces. At the moment, as we know, the Ministry of the Interior has far too much power, and some of this power will be hived off, and the provincial governors will no longer report to the Ministry of the Interior, but will report to a new minister, and it is thought, it is rumored, that that minister will be Prince Salman, who is desperate to, he's done a wonderful job as governor of Riyadh, he's desperate to have proper ministerial responsibility, and he shouldn't have defense, and so there's talk that he will have this new ministry, and Prince Naif will find this acceptable. There's quite a lot of rivalry between Prince Naif and Prince Salman. He will find this acceptable by becoming the sort of new prime minister. Now, this is all the sort of talk one hears in majlises. It may not be true, but I think certainly some things are going to happen in the next year, and we will look back and see the economic package as King Abdullah very cleverly taking finally he could go to Asaf, the finance minister, and say, I don't care about the rial wobbling and keeping up our dollar reserves. You know, let's spend some money. Because the track record of this man, and I'll stop with this, Chris, the track record of this man has been reform, has been change, has been trying to change things. And that is our one very obvious difference between Egypt and Tunisia, where men were deposed who were standing for the very opposite. And the Saudi experience in the last 9 or 10 years has been of things opening up, especially for the radicals. But of course, radicals are the first people to want more. They're allowed to speak a bit in the press, so they want to demonstrate in the streets. And we'll see what happens on March the 11th.
Great. I'd like to open this up for questions. And what I'd like to do is take sort of groups of questions. So I'd like to start in the front. And please, there's a microphone coming around. And please introduce yourself.
Honor de Borgraf, CSIS. Do you totally discount what has been happening in places like Bahrain and Jordan towards the move towards some form of constitutional monarchy as opposed to an absolute monarchy? And what do you make of this thing that's circulating on the internet now of March 16th being the day of rage in Saudi Arabia?
Well, let's take a few more.
Yes, my name is Greg Aftandili, and I'm an independent consultant. My question deals with the issue of youth unemployment in Saudi Arabia. How serious do you see it? And do these young unemployed university graduates have a political ideology of sorts, or are they all over the map on that? Thank you.
And then the front. We'll take one more.
Thanks. Ali Liami from the Center for Democracy and Human Rights in Saudi Arabia. Robert, 60 to 70% of the Saudi population are under the age of 25. They are totally disconnected from the past, and they didn't see any hope for the future. They compare themselves with all their counterparts in the Arab world, including the Gulf and the rest of the world. The title of this conference is whether the Tahrir will come to Saudi Arabia or not. Given the fact that most Saudis are looking for something more than handout, Will Saudi Arabia and the royal family be spared the Arab revolt? If yes, tell us why. If not, tell us why not.
Thank you very much for those questions. Well, sir, I don't think Jordan and Saudi Arabia have much to do with each other. I mean, maybe because I just don't know much about Jordan. Jordan seems to me a completely different situation. Bahrain, obviously, does have enormous impact on Saudi Arabia. Bahrain is like the 14th province of Saudi Arabia. It's connected by the causeway. And as we know, the causeway exists for most Saudis as a means to drive to the flesh pots at the weekend for the alcohol and the women. But it has a serious strategic purpose so that Saudi armed forces can go across to shore up the regime in Bahrain, as they did in the 1990s. I seriously doubt whether America will let Saudi Arabia do that this time, but I don't know. I spend a lot of time in the East. I spend a lot of time with Shia, Sheikh Hassan al-Safar, Jafar Shaib, and the very influential Shia who were, until 1990, until the Gulf War, were the most effective opponents of Saudi Arabia here in this country. You know, they were the first people who were clever enough to change their name from the Iranian Revolutionary Party to the Society for Human Rights in the Arabian Peninsula. The moment they said human rights, you know, NPR couldn't get enough of them. And very clever they were, and it's the path that other people have followed since then. They have come back to Saudi Arabia. They are. You know, it was very interesting. The moment Iraq attacked, they stopped their opposition. They rallied round in the way that I think, you know, Saudis do. And I spoke to them the other day in Katif on the phone, and you know, very cleverly, cautiously said, well, they said, there are a lot of petitions circulating. And I said, well, you know, do you support them? And they said, well, off the record, we do support them, but on the record, we don't. We know that if we, the Shia, spoke up and said we like this particular reform proposal, that would kill it because of the prejudice against us in Saudi Arabia. This question of the Day of Rage, you mentioned two dates. I think the date of the 11th may be genuine. The talk of this date of the 16th on the internet, I'm not an Arabist, but Arabists have said to me, it doesn't read, or Saudis have said to me, it doesn't read like proper Arabic. And if you run it through Google, you end up with perfect English, as though it's come from somewhere inauthentic. Now, that doesn't rule out the 11th. I mean, the human rights people I know in Riyadh are talking about that. I don't know what's going to happen. I mean, the ones I know, I mean, I have a friend, I mention his name because he goes on the record with what he says, Mohammed al-Qahtani. He is a man who's actually written a letter to King Abdullah calling for the dismissal of Prince Naif and calling for him to be tried for his offenses against human rights. I went with Mohammed the other day to the Court of Grievance, where he's fighting some of these cases. The man, for reasons I can't quite understand, is still at liberty, and he is organizing what's happening on March the 11th. It remains to be seen. We were just discussing, Chris and I, beforehand, perhaps facetiously, where Tahrir Square should be in Riyadh. I mean, the logical place is right outside the Miznak Fortress, but that would be, in a tribal society, an immense offense to the House of Saud, because the Miznak Fortress, which is the scene of Abdulaziz's triumph, would be considered be a direct insult to the family. Youth unemployment, obviously, the most incredible problem and challenge facing this country, facing so many countries. I mean, one of the sad ironies of the last 7 or 8 years is the incredible economic development of Saudi Arabia. 7 or 8 million jobs have been created and added to the economy, and they've all gone to foreigners. They've all gone to expatriates. And we think, you know, how stupid the Saudis are to let that happen. But it's just what happens in America with immigrant workers. It's just what happens in Britain. In the world today, where you have inexpensive foreign labor available, what businessman cannot afford to employ them? Dear Zaki Ghazi Ghazebi, when he was Minister of Labor, spent an afternoon flipping hamburgers in a Saudi McDonald's to say it is not beneath the dignity of young Saudi men to flip hamburgers, and he got laughed at. And I'm sure if the British Minister of Labour went into a McDonald's and flipped hamburgers and said, you know, it is not beneath the dignity of young Brits to flip hamburgers, he would get laughed at too, because flipping hamburgers is for immigrants, it's for non-whites, it's, you know, it's for all the politically incorrect things. But that's the reality of it. And the economic reality is that Saudi Arabia is in a cleft stick. It sends King Abdullah's generous, you know, I'm here in connection with the IMAX film that's just showing at the Smithsonian. We quoted 60,000-70,000 students abroad. It's already 120,000. I mean, King Abdullah, I think, is deliberately creating a problem in sending young Saudis abroad to be opened up and to come back thinking as Westerners think. And of course, the idea was that the economic cities would provide the job. That was the answer. When the old answer to your question was, six economic cities will provide jobs for these young people. Well, the economic cities scarcely move, so far as I can see. I remember when I first came back in 2006, I went to see the Abdullah Economic City north of Jeddah, and it was just flat, and there was an area over there, a bit of desert. They said that's where this new College of the Kings is going to get created. Well, 2 years later, the College of the King stands up there, Kaust, wonderful thing. There's just a few apartment blocks for the King Abdullah Economic City. I mean, part of the problem was that the idea was it would be foreign investment. And with the world economic crisis, who's going to invest whatever money they have in Saudi Arabia? That is why, actually, spending 10% extra of your government budget actually can make a difference to this sort of thing. I just have a weird theory that, you know, it would waste a lot of money, but maybe a fund ought to be created for young Saudis to start their own businesses. I think that's part of the package, because one of the problems with Saudis is they don't want to work for anybody else. They want to work for the government, because that's safe and prestigious. You go in at 7, you're finished at 2, you can do something else, you retire when you're 50, you can use all your networking to make lots of money. That's what people want to do. So, you know, if young entrepreneurs seem to me the way ahead, sort of, that's the idea of Kaust, that it would be,
this question about Saudi Arabia, yes or no, would this happen in Saudi Arabia?
Well, I've spent so long on the other questions, no, it won't. Thank you.
How about another round of questions? Yes, sir. There's a microphone coming.
Sorry, I just want to say one thing about this. Yes, these young people in Saudi Arabia who are also radical and, signing up for human rights. I don't know if you saw that MTV film about a young Saudi who, over the internet, picked up a girl, made friends with another Saudi girl, and they arranged to meet in a shopping mall. And he went to the shopping mall with the film crew, and he was stopped because young males are not allowed into shopping malls at the weekend. So he came away furious, and that was the end of the MTV segment. What it didn't show, because I asked him afterwards, I said, I can see why you're angry. So you're happy. Would you be happy for your sister? This is a young Saudi. Would you be happy for your sister to meet someone on the internet and go and meet them in the mall? He said, of course not. My sister's going to marry who I decide and our brothers decide. That's young, you know, the idea that young Saudis are young hippies who, I think the problem with young Saudis is that they are too fundamentalist, they're too conservative. And let's not forget, the conservative Muslims don't want democracy. They don't want rule by the people, they want rule by God. They don't trust the ballot box. What happened when there was voting in Saudi Arabia for the municipal elections? All the bearded ones got returned. The nice Western liberals who spoke English, there were campaigns on mobile phones. So-and-so was educated in America. So-and-so this, so-and-so that. He speaks English. He's brought back an English wife, foreign wife. Anybody like that got counted out. So I see the youth of Saudi Arabia as deeply conservative. And that's, you know, that's a longer, slightly longer reason for my no. Sorry.
Hi. Kenneth Rothschild, Independent. A couple of questions on security. What is the military situation? What is the internal, like, police situation? agreements with the United States? What are they? What kind of things? How could you, if there was a problem, how do you see it developing? Does Al-Qaeda have any influence? Is bin Laden have any connections still internally? Those kind of things.
Very good questions. Yes, there is. It's about three there already. But
Some more questions, though? Yes, Ambassador, and then we'll go in the back.
David Newton, Middle East Institute. Early in mid-career, I served in Saudi Arabia. There is supposed to be something of a new system for the approval of a new king or a crown prince. From your talk, I got the impression, though, it's still pretty much business as usual with the geriatric succession. Do you see any likelihood that system will change in the next 10, 20 years?
Oh, well, I'll take that question first.
Robert, Judith Kipper, I have to take exception a little bit with what I think I've heard you say. It seems to me that Saudi Arabia's most serious strategic security problem, economic as well, is the demographic bulge. There's about 20 million Saudis today. In 20 years, there will be 40 million. They double every 20 years. 60% are under age 18, 40% under age 13. And these youngsters, whether they are conservative or liberal or somewhere in between, and I'm not sure really how you measure that, want the same thing as everybody else. They want somebody to care about their aspirations, to pay attention to them, to provide the possibility to have a career, not just a job, but a career. There are no jobs, there are no careers. Between 18 and 24-year-old Saudis, 40% are unemployed. So it's how do you have a career, a decent life, housing, ability to get married, to remain in the family circle, which is the glue that holds everything together, but to have enough independence as a cable generation, internet-informed youngsters. And the elite at the top are totally, all our friends, you and I know a lot of the same people, they're completely out of touch with this. Most Saudis are poor.
Judith, I agree with lots of what you say. I don't actually agree that the elite are particularly out of touch with this. But these problems you mentioned, housing, a massive, massive problem. And, of course, it's exacerbated in Jeddah, where I spend so much time, two floods, people killed, people out of, the graphic illustration of the incompetence of the Saudi system and its shortcomings is obvious. I'm not trying to minimize these problems, but to go back to this point you made to start with, the demographics, 20, 40, 60 million, that's quite true. There are too many Saudis getting created, and there's absolutely no wish or impulse on the part of the government to try and educate against that, or the church. But there you are, the church. The question is, these are all time bomb issues, and they are issues that are discussed. What I am taking issue with is the idea that Western democratic solutions to this are what these people are asking for. These young people are, in my experience, deeply conservative. And CNN and I'm not sure about Al Jazeera would welcome liberal reforms. If a constitutional monarchy and steps towards it are introduced, the radicals and the liberals that play so much a role and whom I agree with will cheer. What will a constitutional monarchy mean to these 20, 40, 60 million kids? That will mean no more to them than the existing system. When I lived in Saudi Arabia the first time, many of the local governors were technocrats. They were educated Saudis who'd come back from Indiana and someone with their PhDs did their best running the local communities. There's not a single one of those left now. They're all princes. And why are they princes? Not because the royal family pushed them, because local communities said, we want a prince. We don't want some technocrat who's got a degree in social management or town planning. We want a prince who can phone the king and get us what we want. And so what I'm trying to argue is that we have to look for traditional, we have to try and get into the Saudi mindset and see traditional solutions. I am not sure that a career in the Western sense is in the Saudi mindset of many young Saudis. I don't know. I just don't. I'm just not at all sure. That's the, you know, that's what they're on. How to get married? Absolutely. You know, very interesting that the first thing that Chris's friends on the care program do is get these kids married and provide the money, the $20,000 or so that is needed to get married. And I've got a friend in the program whose wife was infertile, and the government paid for her fertility treatment. And you know, there are young Saudis who say, why are all these ex-terrorists getting all these special deals? That's the sort of level at which people are thinking. And just on the subject of getting married, and, you know, some of you have heard me say this before, there's good news on this front, because apparently now the bride price in Jeddah for a working wife is higher than the bride price for a non-working wife. So, you know, there is recognition in the most basic way that women must be employed. And, you know, that is why the driving ban is going to end, because too many of my young male Saudi friends are fed up with getting up in the morning, taking the kids to school, going to work, coming home early, taking the kids, then have to take the wife out to the supermarket. That is going to change. But that's all to do with social things. You know, it's not to do with religion. The new system, sir, that you asked about, I didn't want to suggest that the new system has been bypassed. Prince Talal said that when because of the illness of Prince Sultan and King Abdullah needing to travel, there was a desperate need for a third person to be named. It was said that the naming of Prince Naif shortcut the electoral system. That is true, but the electoral system can only happen when somebody dies. And then I think it will work. I mean, one of the, those of you who have read my book will know that Prince Naif, who, again, always thought of as conservative, and, of course, as a Sudairi with his own bloc vote, might not have been expected to welcome democracy, was one of the chief princes pushing for this. But I think when they do meet to vote, they will vote with these issues I've raised already of seniority and competence, and so it's going to be Prince Naif succeeded by Prince Salman. And the odd thing about that is that this electoral system, for the first time, will actually bring into power two Sudairis together. Until now, the family has always been careful to balance the Sudairi with someone else. Well, in that generation, there simply is no one else to match the competence or record or reputation of Salman. And Salman is a major possibility of reform in the future. He has his men, you know, all these liberal majlises that are held on Monday nights, Salman's men are there listening to them, and that may be why they're not getting into trouble for what they're saying. So, again, it's just very dangerous to, you know, speculate about the future on the basis of, you know, personalities. But as I say, I don't feel that Prince Naif is as conservative. He's not a dreadfully pious character. But you know, he is conservative. And then there is Salman. The last question, sir, from Mr. Rothschild. Big question about the military side of things. I thought, as a Brit who was terribly upset about this great deal that America has done with Saudi Arabia, monopolizing all the arms that are cutting us Europeans out, I was very pleased to hear about these rumors that Obama and Abdullah had quarreled on the phone, because I thought, oh, maybe now the arms deal won't go through and there's a chance for Europeans. Well, 2 days later, it's announced the arms deal is moving faster than ever is going to happen. And in fact, you know, what this arms deal does, it's much more than, I mean, it's been sold, it works in America because, you know, the first time the Israeli lobby have to yield to the fact that it will create 60,000 jobs. And, you know, normally there's no reason for an American congressman to argue with the Israeli lobby. I mean, why cause trouble? But now there's a real alternative. Are you going to vote against 60,000 jobs in the country? And the Saudis have shrewdly seized this moment and pushed it through, and that's why I think they are pushing it through. But of course, the result of it is that it's turning, it will turn Saudi Arabia into an American battleship. It means that, or whatever, helicopter cockpit or whatever you like to think, it means really, although these arms are being sold to the Saudis to use, it means that if there is ever really serious trouble in the Middle East, American personnel can come in, as they came in 1990, and just take over all the weapon systems, operate them, and do whatever they have to do. As you know, this new military deal gives helicopter potential to the National Guard for the first time, and that obviously, when it comes to the repression of internal disorder, gives the National Guard an enormous extra potential. I think America should bless Saudi Arabia as sustaining your arms industry so generously, but as I say, that's a British point of view.
Well, thank you very much. I'm afraid that we're nearly out of time, so I'd like to thank you for sharing all of your insights. One of the things that really strikes me is that, you know, Saudi Arabia is a place that you need to have an awful lot of understanding, an awful lot of context to get a good grasp on. And one of the fascinating things, you know, as a researcher is it strikes me that, you know, this is something that you mentioned, that over the course of the past 80 years, how much has changed in Saudi Arabia and how much tension and change is going on in society, which I think we probably don't appreciate as often as we should. So I'd like to thank you again for coming, and please join me in thanking Robert.